Welcome to the ADHD Alchemy Podcast, where women with ADHD finally feel seen, understood, and unapologetically themselves. If you have ever felt like you're too much and not enough all at the same time, you're in the right place because that's the alchemy, learning how both come together to make something priceless. I'm Jessica Covington, holistic ADHD coach and fellow fancy brain, and I'm really glad you're here. Let's get into it. Welcome to ADHD Alchemy. It's more than a podcast. It's also my signature coaching program at Fitology. I built it for bright, sensitive women who are tired of feeling scattered and chaotic and ready to feel calm, clear, and finally in control. Inside the program, group or private, you'll finally drop the mask and start thriving. Together, we'll quiet the relentless inner critic, break old patterns of procrastination and self-sabotage, and begin redefining ADHD on your own terms. In just a few weeks, you'll find yourself grounded, confident, and leading your life with intention by learning to work with your fancy brain instead of against it. If that speaks to you, find more at fitology.com. That link, of course, will be in the show notes. Today, we have with us Dr. Sarah Hapnin, a performance scientist, ADHD coach, and speaker who helps high-performing humans train their brains and bodies for sustainable success. She holds a PhD in sport and exercise psychology and is an internationally published researcher in motivation and optimal human performance. As a former elite athlete, she found out just 12 days before the Olympics that she would not be going, an experience that deeply shaped her work around identity, resilience, and pressure. She's also the creator of the Move at Work Challenge program, a workplace wellness program featured at the National Institutes of Health in a business showcase highlighting 8 years of success across Colorado's largest school districts. Dr. Sarah blends science, lived experience, and practical brain-body strategies to help ADHD brains build clarity, energy, and follow through without the burnout. So, Dr. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Awesome. You've lived a high-achieving lifetime as an athlete, a master's and PhD graduate, a serial entrepreneur. And the first time you brought up ADHD to a healthcare provider, they said you were far too smart and too good of a student to have ADHD, which is such a myth. What are some of the other misconceptions that you've run across in your ADHD journey?
I think that you're broken or that this is a disability. It's just a difference. It's you are not broken. You are not disabled. There are so many misconceptions. I think a lot of the regular, I don't love that terminology either because I think we're all unique in our brain types, whether they're diagnosed ADHD or not. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what ADHD is and how it works. And I know for me, once I discovered that everyone's brain did not think like mine, that there's not 20 million thoughts going on at the same time that you can see ahead, that you're watching a TV show and you know who's the killer and like what the sly things are happening on the side. Like once I realized that everyone's brain did not work the same way as mine, it made a lot more sense. I remember my husband and I have been together for over 23 years. Next month we're going to be celebrating our 15-year anniversary in Hawaii. That's where we got married. But I remember when we were first dating and you're like really into this person when you know it's their person. They're your person. And I remember I'd ask him, like, it would just be quiet. And I was like, what are you thinking about? Like, what's going on in your head? And I think he got annoyed with me because he'd be like, oh, nothing. And I'm like, that doesn't happen. There's never quiet in my brain. So I would always, I just assumed everyone thought the same way that I did. So I think that's just really interesting now knowing a lot more about it, that no, everyone's brain does not work the same as mine, but there are lots of thoughts happening at once. And I do take medication. And then you have one thought at a time. And that's challenging for my brain, especially on stage, because I also have traumatic brain injuries in all lobes of my brain because of my sport and lots of concussions, but I often forget words. So my amazing ADHD brain has new connections and will come up with tons of other ways to say the same thing. But for me, when I'm medicated and I have one thought at a time and I'm on stage and I forget a word, my brain's like, what's that word? What's that word? And I can't move on, which is challenging. So I don't know if the normal population, the non-ADHD people have that. But that was just really interesting. And now I'm reflecting that that is definitely a difference of my brain.
Yeah, and a massive challenge, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, how did your history as an athlete and then a graduate student and serial entrepreneur, how did that all prompt you to study motivation?
I think I was always trying to figure out my brain. And I didn't know, so I didn't get a diagnosis until it was time for me to finish my PhD. And you can't be a PhD student for 10 years. So it was my ninth year. I'd taken 7 years off because I was no longer interested in doing academic research work. I just wanted to work with people. And at that point, I'd started my company in 2013. I kind of, long story short, didn't want to do research. So I took 7 years off and then I kind of forgot about it. And my supervisor, during that time, we were kind of publishing research and I was doing it here and there, but really had a strong dislike for everything in the academic world. And now that I know my brain, it makes sense. It's all about like people telling you what you have to do. And you're publishing research and work, and all these really amazing human beings who are top of the field get to put their name on your research paper ahead of your name. Like they did all of it, but you've actually done all of it. And then, anyways, that gets me really elevated, as you can tell. But I think I studied motivation when I first got started, because I was like, if I could just figure this out, then I can focus on things I don't care about, like history. I was a straight A student and I tried so hard because I had to win everything in class. But certain things I really didn't give any shits about, like history for one, anything like political, anything boring for my brain. I always say, like, our brains are light switches, they're on or they're off. There's no like mid light switch level. So for me, and at that point, it was very relevant to me. So I was studying my undergrad. I did kinesiology and health promotion and psychology. And prior to going to school, I thought I wanted to be a vet. And I'm so thankful during my last year of high school, I had the opportunity to work in a veterinarian's office for a co-op placement and saw how many animals were actually like brought in and euthanized, and all they do is spays and neuter. So I'm so grateful for that opportunity. I didn't go down that road, but I still loved animals. And we were studying psychology, and my professor, it was one of those like 300 people class, says, "Does anyone here have a puppy?" Of course, it's college, someone has a puppy. So they're like, "Bring your puppy to class next time." So the teacher on stage with a puppy, and they just do positive reinforcement. And by the end of the class, the puppy can like sit, lay down, stay, roll over, like high five, like do all these things. And the teacher's like, "You train humans exactly the same with positive reinforcement." So my brain immediately was like, "Oh my gosh, I got into brain training." And then, so fast forward, I did a minor in psychology. And during my last year of college, I got to do a graduate level sports psychology class. And that was super relevant to me because I was a diver. And I just got super passionate about that. So then I was blessed to be able to move to Finland. That's where I did my master's. And it was the first year they had the program that I was doing in English, so sports and exercise psychology in English, and everything I was learning was so relevant to me. But I'm like, if I learn more about motivation, then I can be motivated to do all these things that I don't like doing. And then that's not how it works. I actually created my own way, my own, based on the research that I did in motivation, like how you can use that to motivate any ADHDer. But it's just really ironic because and now I'm looping back. I went down a rabbit hole, but I'm back. During that last year, when my supervisor was like, "You can't be a PhD student for 10 years," I was like, "Okay, now's the time. Like, we're gonna do it." So I go to open a document that I had written that was very academic. And if you know, if you write academic, the main point is to make it so confusing so regular humans don't know what you're saying. Like, use really big words that sound really smart and academic wise. And then you just publish research for other researchers. So never gets back to the people that need it. But it's okay. There is academia that's good too, but I didn't understand. I couldn't understand my own research, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm broken. So then I got a brain scan. They do two brain scans, one under a concentration task, and then they inject like radioactive isotope in you, and then you do a different one a few days later, or it was vice versa. But basically, they said you have impeded blood flow in your frontal lobe during concentration tasks, aka you have probably have ADHD. And then I went down a rabbit hole, and they diagnosed me with a lot of other stuff like traumatic brain injury, anxiety, and depression. I knew I had depression. I didn't know I had anxiety because I do health and fitness. So I was working out every day until I got COVID and I couldn't work out. And then my anxiety was raging. And I was like, oh, I've been self-managing my ADHD through movement, through eating right, moving your body. And I had all these coping skills and strategies because I had been studying optimal human performance and motivation and the self-determination theory and all these things on how to be your best self. So I was applying them. But yeah, it was really ironic and funny when, but thank God I didn't have like a brain tumor or anything like that. They're like, no, you just have ADHD and you need to take the next steps. And then a few years after that, I got diagnosed again with a psychiatric nurse practitioner so that I could try meds. But that was my diagnosis story of why I studied motivation. Now I look back and it's like, because I had ADHD and I just wanted to figure it out.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So, in some ways, this is cutting to the chase, but I would love to know, in all of that research you did on motivation, what's the number one biggest, most important thing you learned in all of that research?
Three things. This is from Desi and Ryan's self-determination theory. There are three things you need for anybody on the planet to be motivated. This has been proven across cultures, across fields. So athletics, corporate, like business, school, whatever it is. To remember, I say car, like driving a car. So the C stands for competence. This is the belief that you can be competent. So you might not have the competence now. This is an example I always share. I'm a homeowner. I've been in this house for 11 years now. It's crazy, time flies. But I was not competent to install a toilet, but I knew I could learn and have the skills. So it's not even necessarily having the competence yet, it's having the belief that you can be competent if you learn about it. So, competence is number one. You have to have the actual belief that you can do whatever the thing is that you're doing. The second thing is autonomy, which this is your own decision that you're doing this. So, I see this a lot. One of the things I do in my business, hashtag ADHD, is like personal training, right? So, I'll get someone super fit and they want me to work with their significant other. And I'm like, whoa, 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 what does the significant other want? It doesn't matter like how much money you throw at me or how much they show up. If they don't want to, if they're not participating in the choice to do this, then it's not going to work. Like, I can't, unless they have autonomy in their own decision. So I know probably you work with a lot of women. There might be parentals watching this. So you can use this as a trick for your kiddos, whatever you want. Let's just say your kids are at the playground, you need them to go to the car. And especially if you have neurodivergent children who are going to have demand avoidance, you say, are we skipping to the car or are we running to the car? Those kids will get to the car. And the fact that you give them a little bit of choice, a little bit of autonomy in that decision is like game changer because they don't feel then they're not going to have that demand avoidance. I do it in the gym all the time. I'm like, do you want 15 or 20 pounds? Either way, they're lifting a weight. And I really like that's a nice secret tip. So C, competence, A, autonomy, and then relatedness or belongingness. But the original one is relatedness. So we are humans. We are meant to be on this planet with other humans who are doing similar things. Like that saying, the five people you surround yourself with the most, they're going to have influence over you, and influence over your life. But relatedness is really important, like being part of a community, being surrounded by humans who care about you, who are doing the same things you are doing. Those are like the three basic psychological needs as far as motivation and well-being and all those things
Yeah,
go.
absolutely. And so those three concepts are universal, ADHD or not.
Yes.
Got it. Very nice. So now you work in your coaching practice, you work with organizations as well as individuals, right?
Correct.
Can you say a bit about what organizational work looks like, who it helps, how it helps, and the form it takes?
Yeah. So within organizations to have real kind of change, that takes some time. So there's different ways. Sometimes I'll go into an organization and just do like a 1 hour workshop or presentation or 90 minutes. And that's great. Like that's way better than nothing. And a lot of that is just education. I love to educate like what neurodiversity looks like, how it affects different people. And it very much depends on the organization. So for instance, in a few months, I'm going to be speaking at the Art and Science of Health Promotion on neurodivergence, which is broader than ADHD. And I've spoken at like the Salvation Army to talk just about ADHD. And of course, my expertise is ADHD, so that's what I love. But with that short little presentation, that's nice to give them education, give them some tips and tricks and a toolbox. But basically, when I go in, my goal, the organization has a goal as well, but a lot of it is increasing understanding and reducing stigma. And what it looks like and what we like to do here is universally designed. So because all of our concepts, a lot of the programming that we do is based in psychobiosocial states and optimal performance, which helps everybody, regardless of their neurodivergence, but setting up systems and client climates for success, regardless of neurotype, but that can be very helpful for the neurodivergent human. So if we're just doing like a short presentation, we'll go in and just do a lot of like a brief overview and tips and tricks and a little toolbox. And usually they get a workbook and there's like a little bit of discussion. But if there's an organization that wants to take it deeper, we go in there and might work with them for up to a year. And it really starts with like leadership and doing different, we call it peak performance profiling and talking to the leaders and finding out what the gaps are and kind of filling through and talking about how you, I would say communication and feedback in an organization are the main things we work on. And then with, so neurodivergence is challenging because a lot of people, even if they have it, they don't necessarily want to disclose it at work because it
Right.
can be seen for them as like a disability. And you can still get accommodations even if you aren't willing to label yourself as neurodivergent. And the stat is 20% of the population is neurodivergent in a typical population. But if it depends on the industry, like if you're going into a tech company, that's going to be a lot higher. If they're all like building apps and stuff, I would say they might tend to have more neurodivergent. So it really depends. Nothing we do, except for a Move at Work Challenge, which is a different program, not with neurodivergence. Nothing is like one size fits all because we're all unique and organizations are unique and what their needs are unique. But sorry, that was a really long answer to say. I guess it depends what the organization is, how big it is, what they need, what their budget is, and where their gaps are.
Yeah, that's great. What do you think is the most common request when organizations come to you and say, we need to have you come in and help us be more inclusive? Do they have a particular request or problem that they're looking to solve, or is it just a way of enriching their employees?
It depends. A lot of them want to make sure they're doing it as like a preventative so that they're covering their butts in case anything is going to happen. Or they've had more than a handful of people ask for accommodations, and they don't know like what that looks like or how they proceed or what that's gonna be like. When the Salvation Army approached me, they were looking for, because they're a lot more like hands-on, and the people that they were helping had a lot of mental health issues. So they knew that they're, because they deal a lot with like homelessness and people who are on the streets, and they were looking for education for their people, that when they're doing their volunteer work or they're out in the real world, did they know how to interact if these people are neurodivergent or ADHD. So I think it really just depends on the organization, but I would say accommodations is a huge one. And then what ends up on my end, once we dig into it a lot, is communication, feedback, and systems that are going to keep their employees productive. That's what I see, but they don't know that they need to ask for that until you're in it. But the systems, the follow-up, communication, I say, would be huge. That would be the biggest one. But they don't reach out saying, "We're struggling with communication. This must be an ADHD thing." Like, they don't know that. It's after we do a whole bunch of profiles and start talking to them, and it's like, okay, this is where you're dropping the ball. This is like, my big joke. Well, not a joke, it's serious, but I say it funnily in a joke, is like, once you're leaving a meeting with an ADHD, or like, always just ask them, do you know what the next step is? Do you know how you should be prioritizing? Do you need help with prioritizing? Do you have a deadline? Like, just these little things that you can also ask someone who's not self-defining themselves as ADHD. Like, these will help all humans. But if they do have a specific brain type that is lacking in the executive functioning blood flow, like, just kind of priming the sorts of questions and follow-ups, and do you want me to check in on you tomorrow afternoon to see what your progress is, right? Because we know we don't necessarily show up for ourselves, but we'll show up for everybody else. And like, delegating and prioritizing, like, those are all things that are very challenging. So those obviously are problems, but the organization doesn't know until you like do an assessment and say, like, ooh, if you just created a system for this, this would help a lot. But they're not going to know to ask for that. But that's what we see, is communication, feedback, and creating systems of success and changing the culture from the inside.
I'm so glad you said all of that because I used to be in HR myself, and there was this great fear in lots of different kinds of organizations that somebody might self-identify, might ask for accommodations, and the people in the C-suites were just kind of terrified of that sometimes because they thought it meant we're going to have to do something very complicated, very difficult, very uncomfortable, and probably very expensive in order to make this work. And it doesn't have to be that way at all. As you rightly pointed out, these are things that are often free. They're simple, they're easy tweaks and changes to make, and they're good for everybody. It's just a matter of adding leadership skills, really. So, yeah, thank you for shining a light on that. I'd love to shift gears a little bit, not entirely, and talk about the impact of ADHD in relationships. You mentioned earlier before we started recording that since you stopped masking a long time ago, people either love you or they leave you alone. And I wonder, have there been friendships or other relationships that maybe have faded out because of your different thinking style? Or maybe some have become even deeper.
So us ADHDers, and I'll just speak for myself, but if you're listening and you have ADHD, you might have this thing called object permanence, which, out of sight, out of mind, right? But that also applies to humans. As I mentioned, like, I did my master's and PhD in Finland. There's a lot of amazing humans who I went to school with there who I don't have. They just don't exist to me in my brain until I see them post something on Facebook, and then I'll be like, "Oh, how are you?" And I can reach out, I can send a voice message, but it's not that I dislike them, or it's not that they ever wronged me. It's just I don't see them and they don't exist. They're not high dopamine. So this stuff works if you have things in your house and you hide them right away, unless they're cookies. Cookies are high dopamine, so you're gonna know you put them in the tin at the top of your on top of your fridge or whatever, regardless if you can't see them. And humans are kind of the same. So with relationships, knowing this is a thing, every month or so, sometimes I'll just scroll through my phone, going all the way to the bottom, and just with the mindset of who's someone I need to reach out to. What's a relationship I want to rekindle, or who's someone who I haven't talked to in a long time? And of course, I have reminders all over the place. Like, when's my a week before my best friend's birthday, I'll get a calendar reminder. And it's just, I tell my humans not to beat themselves up about it. You might notice when you're on vacation, if you're significant, especially if I go to a conference and my significant other isn't texting me or I don't see, like, it's not that I don't love him any less. I'm just, my brain is occupied with something else. But with that being said, also certain relationships, especially with people who are in your life who think differently, like family and whatnot, who you don't get to necessarily choose and you still want to have a relationship with. I think with those relationships, it's kind of important to have a little bubble around yourself because, at least with me, I tend to have rejection sensitivity and demand avoidance and all these things. So sometimes with specific humans, I have to have a bubble and I'm like, I'm here, and they might say some stuff and it's just a bubble and it's bouncing right off and they're going to get it right back at them. But to decide, I guess, what are you reacting to and where are you spending your energy? I know in the ADHD world, there's this concept of spoons, right? We have less spoons than a normal human has during the day. And what are you going to spend your energy with? Because there's relationships that you no longer want in your life, and if they're toxic, like, please leave those in your past. Then there's relationships with people that you have to have that maybe aren't easy for you. So that's when I say put the bubble on, and I will also say with unmasking, and you might find this, I don't know if I've talked about this on the interwebs before, but with unmasking and letting go of people pleasing, which I'm sure your humans are working on too, right?
Absolutely.
What you're going to realize is relationships with people you had before, now that you're doing internal work and realizing like how your brain works, you've probably been managing their emotions for them. And once you stop doing that, those people get really angry at you and they'll say things like, why did you've changed? Or like they try and make you the victim and don't let any of that stuff happen. Like, yeah, you've changed. You're no longer managing their emotions for them. You have your own emotions and reactions and life that you need to do. So boundaries are really good. You can work on boundary language before you get into these situations if you know stuff like this is going to happen. But also, I think giving yourself permission to step away and pausing is also great. Like, and for ADHDers, it's challenging because we're pretty flat unless we care. Then it's like we're super elevated or like really upset. Like, there's no really in between. We don't really care unless it's time to care. And then we kind of explode. So with those situations, I always like to say, allow some pause, allow some deep breaths. You can remove yourself from the situation. But also, many of us know what relationships cause these things. So before we're going in it, put on your bubble, get ready, have some boundary language set up. And yeah, they're going to be like, you've changed. And you're like, hell yeah, I've changed. Look at me now, you know? But, and then there's other relationships that are great. And we have to put effort into relationships with the people who you want to be in your life who you don't see every day. Like, they don't exist in your brain. So make a note or do what I do once a month, scroll through your phone or your Facebook or whatever, and actively, consciously say, I'm going to choose to reach out to one person a week. Or three people this month that I haven't talked to in a long time. And I think cultivating and working on relationships, like, We're humans. It takes work for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But prepare yourself for the hard stuff because it's not all easy.
Yeah. Just building a couple of little systems around those behaviors can make a big difference. What's your, in a similar vein, what's your message to the people who care about someone who has ADHD and also feel a little hurt by their actions, even though they know it's not intentional?
I think communication. I think it works on both ends. If you miss someone, or if they said they were going to do something and they totally forgot, we never know, as humans, we perceive all this stuff, but we never know what another person is thinking about us. Like, they're going to have their judgments regardless, or what they have going on in their life. So if an ADHDer has hurt you by not getting back to them, a really easy a text or a phone call, or just reaching out or letting them know, you didn't get back to me. Are you doing okay? Often on the ADHDer side, first we might see it and respond in our head, and then literally a second later we forget that that text went by. And you might see it as, like, Jessica might be like, "Well, Sarah's super mad at me. She didn't respond to me." And for me, it's literally, like, next thing, done, next thing. Like, I'm thinking about next week. I have no idea that you sent me a text. So take it with a grain of salt and just communicate and say, "Here's where we're at. How can I help? What do you need? Words are important. We're not mind readers."
Yeah. That's great. What do you need is a favorite question of mine. Really good. Dr.
And then
Summer,
also, sorry,
go ahead.
in the future, like, if there's some sort of confrontation or you feel bad, yes, what do you need? But how do we prevent this, or how do we improve this for moving forward? Because as long as it's a learning lesson, yes, you can make mistakes. And if you learn something, then it's a life lesson. And next time we do better, right? So it might be, okay, I need to set a reminder to text Jessica back. Or whatever it is. Let's take a learning lesson from that and apply it to our future self.
Exactly. Make better mistakes next time.
Fail forward faster.
Yes. Dr. Sara, thank you so much for being here and sharing all of this wisdom. I have enormous respect for the work you're doing, and I know stories like this are helping other people see that they're not alone in this, they're not broken, they're just different, and different is good. So I'd love for you to share, for those who want to reach out to learn more about you and your work, how can they find you?
Yes, this will be good because we're working on it right now. And if I say it out loud, it's going to happen. So
Great.
we're working on our new website, drsara.com. So my name is spelled SAARA.com. And if you go there right now, you could just sign up for my email list. But for ADHDers, I have a 20 plus habit checklist, how to get started to do hard things. And that's available at moveatworkchallenge.com/ADHD habits. And that will give you a list of how to get started to do those hard tasks, because I know we all have that issue.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Time for your ADHD Alchemy Lab Kit. Three ideas from this episode that you can start using today. First up, motivation isn't a feeling and it never comes first. Most people wait to feel motivated, but brains don't work that way, especially ADHD brains. Real motivation needs three conditions and it follows action. The first condition is competence, which is the belief that you can learn it. The second is autonomy, feeling that you're choosing this yourself. And third is relatedness. So instead of doing it alone, you do it in relation to something else. If any one of these is missing, motivation can collapse. So your experiment is, before starting a hard task, ask yourself which of these things is missing right now, and then fix that. Instead of believing that your discipline is lacking. Second, treat your brain like a toddler and give yourself fake choices. Your brain won't actually notice. ADHD brains can tend to hate demands, even self-imposed ones. So stop telling yourself, I have to do this, and instead offer two options that are both acceptable, the same way you would with a toddler. For instance, am I going to start this for 5 minutes or 10? Am I replying by text or voice note? Shall I stop doing this now or after one song? Your brain, just like a toddler would, feels autonomy and the task still gets done. This does work for both kids and adults. Third, treat your relationships like objects, because if you don't see it, it doesn't exist. And that includes people sometimes. That's not selfish or callous or cold. That's a function of object permanence overlapping the dopamine cycle. So try this once a month, or even once a week if you have the time. Scroll to the bottom of your contact lists or your messages. Pick one person and just send a short voice note or a text. No catching up, no guilt, no apology for being out of touch. Just make that connection, because real connection doesn't need intensity, it just needs systems. That's your lab kit for today. I hope you'll try one and let me know how it goes. Thanks for listening to the ADHD Alchemy Podcast. If this episode had you nodding along and thinking, yeah, that's me, make sure you're subscribed and consider sharing it with another woman who might feel a little more seen and a little less alone because of it. Together, we are rewriting the ADHD shame story into one of strength. I'll see you next time.